Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How about a little multiple choice to get going on this Monday, huh? The American real estate market is A, bad, B, bad but improving, C, waiting to figure out the foreclosure mess. If you picked C, or A or B actually, stay tuned. We'll talk about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses and nonprofits make sense of social media. You can learn more at constantcontact.com/social media. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 25th of October. Glad, as always, to have you here. The chairman of the Fed weighed in on the foreclosure mess today. Ben Bernanke said he and the gang at the Federal Reserve are concerned about potential irregularities, those are his words, in foreclosure practices at some of the big banks. They're working on a report that's going to be ready sometime in the next month or so. In the meanwhile, the banks say it's all just a paperwork glitch. Critics say it's substantively more than that. So we're going to start this Monday by dissecting those arguments a little bit. Here to help us do that, we've called Richard Green. He teaches real estate at the University of Southern California. Mike Konzel is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute in New York City. Good to have you both with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Richard Green, the first question, I suppose, goes to you. Why not just sit back and wait and let Bank of America and J.P. Morgan just really figure out the paperwork and have a moratorium?
I think a couple of reasons. First of all, a moratorium will extend the crisis further because it will delay resolution of the problems that we have in the market. And we do ultimately have to resolve this problem one way or the other, either through foreclosure or through loan modification. But there needs to be a sense of urgency about this. And second, I think it sets a bad precedent. And if lenders in the future don't think they're going to be able to take houses back from people who haven't paid for them, they're going to be reluctant to come back into the market.
What if, though, Mike Konzel, we just say, wait a second, let's sit back and look at the documents and figure out what's going on?
Well, exactly. And what do we do for people who are purchasing homes, people who are being foreclosed on right now? So a mortgage has two parts to it. It has the lien and it has the note. The note is the actual debt. It's the terms of your debt. It's what late fees you pay if you don't pay it. And the lien is just says that they can take your house if you don't pay the note. But ultimately, if you have a problem with your mortgage, you need to consult the note.
Right. Those notes are the things that are basically lost, that we don't know where they are.
People are checking right now and they can't find them, which is why we need a moratorium to actually figure out where these things are and what we can do about it.
Richard Green, does it matter that we don't know where the notes are? I mean, isn't it all a paperwork drill?
Oh, of course it matters. And I don't want to in any way be seen as defending the practices of many lenders and servicers. But the problem is a moratorium is such a blunt instrument, and it says everybody, even if you've done your job right, is going to be subject to delaying their ability to foreclose on houses. And I think that creates a whole other set of problems.
Well, I do want to push against the idea that liquidating the homeowners is what's best for our economy. A lot of people seem to have the opinion that we just have so many foreclosures we have to get through, and once we get through them, we're done. This is very dangerous. What we know is that a foreclosure is a lose-lose-lose scenario. It's bad for the homeowner. It's bad for the investors. That's why all these investors are suing the servicers, because they end up with properties that are worth nothing. And it's bad for communities. There's well-documented spillover effects. It devastates local municipality budgets. There's crime. There's all kinds of really bad things that go with foreclosures. What we need is a system in place to allow people to renegotiate their mortgages.
Well, that goes to a bigger point, Richard Green, which is that the reason capitalism works is because we know that when a seller sells, he or she has clear title to sell and the buyer has clear options to purchase. Seems to me capitalism doesn't work if the mortgage system in this country and the documentation of these loans is ineffective.
That's absolutely correct. And that's why this is, I mean, I agree with Mike, this is a huge problem. And it is very disturbing to see the kind of sloppiness in the foreclosure process that we saw in the lending process. But that doesn't mean we need to help out every single borrower who has taken money out from his or her house. If there is no ability to foreclose on people, I mean, this is just an unpleasant reality. If you can't take people's houses away from them, you're not going to have a mortgage system.
So, Mike Konzel, let me ask you this, though. I mean, Congress is otherwise occupied. They've got the election. The banks are trying to move past this as briskly as they can. What then happens if nobody's paying attention?
Well, exactly. Like, if we don't do a moratorium, if we just say, you know, things are in motion, let's just let them play out, well, we know what we're going to see. This is not very good for class action suits. People are with different claims across different states, and it's going to be very hard to mobilize them in order to make banks accountable. You know, the investors are going to slow down this process on their end by suing themselves. And, you know, we're going to suddenly have lawsuits that are floating out there on and foreclosures going through, even though there's lawsuits that have them at stake. But ultimately, you know, we saw this problem back during TARP. You know, we saw this problem with a large history of servicer fraud through the 2000s. Ultimately, it's the same problem over and over again, is that the servicers are not accountable to either investors or homeowners.
Richard Green at the Lusk Center for Real Estate at the University of Southern California, just down the street, and Mike Konzel at the Roosevelt Institute in New York. Gentlemen, thanks.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, housing actually helped the major indices. What do you know about that? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know all those big rigs you share the highway with? They are finally going to have to meet fuel efficiency standards, just like cars have had to do for 35 years or so. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explains why it took so long.
Federal officials today announced plans to force long-haul trucks, school buses, and big pickups to cut fuel consumption by 10% to 20%. The changes would start in the 2014 model year. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood.
It will reduce our reliance on oil, strengthen our energy security, and mitigate climate change.
The government has dictated fuel economy standards for cars since Gerald Ford was president, but freight trucks were exempted, only partly because they play such a key role in national commerce. Dan Becker is at the Center for Auto Safety.
The trucking industry and the auto industry in general have been very powerful and have resisted change.
Experts say advances in hybrid technology and clean diesel have softened some of that resistance. At the same time, corporate awareness of global warming has risen. Many companies, including UPS, already use some short-haul trucks fueled by cleaner natural gas. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The people who keep track of these kinds of things say state budget deficits are going to hit a collective $190 billion this year, almost as much next year. Until now, public university systems have largely been protected from the worst of those cuts. Federal stimulus money filled in the gaps. That boost is running out, though, so states are putting faculty jobs and, in some cases, entire degree programs on the list of things to get rid of. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
That's the Louisiana State fight song. LSU's faculty may need it, with the university facing budget cuts up to 32% next year. English professor Kevin Cope chairs the faculty senate.
These cuts would result in the closure of the equivalent of seven colleges, nearly half the effort of the state's major research university.
Donald Heller of the Center for the Study of Higher Education at Penn State says many public universities are evaluating programs with low enrollment or graduation rates. Some will be eliminated.
There's only so much money you can save not filling open positions or by buying photocopy paper more effectively or by turning down thermostats. At some point, you have to look at those core functions, and that means looking at specific programs and whether you can continue to justify to offer them.
Kevin Cope at LSU worries that liberal arts subjects will suffer the most from budget cuts.
Our business school is undertaking an initiative in Brazil, and yet we're witnessing the dismantling of Portuguese, so it's hard to see how we're going to support these more practical and vocational-oriented programs.
And with such deep budget cuts coming, most degree programs are now under the microscope. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So here politicians tell that the election next week is about jobs, why we lost them, how to get them back, and whose fault it all is anyway. Economists, though, will tell you a different story, that the changes we're seeing in the labor market today actually started decades ago, and that they're probably going to continue, never mind who's in charge of Congress or who's in the White House. We're going to spend some time on the job market this week, what the past and present can tell us about our economic future. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Bluegrass music, deep-fried pumpkin pie, beauty contest for heifers. The North Carolina State Fair is supposed to be fun. This year, though, even that guy paid to be chipper sounds depressed.
Any size of any prize, any bear, anywhere, who's next?
Here, the recession has hit the working class hard. Think of it as an hourglass economy. Jobs have been growing at the top for workers with the most skills and at the bottom. But there's a hollowing out in the middle near the median income of $46,000 per North Carolina household. The national picture is the same. Middle-class workers' employment is down, wages are flat. Take 53-year-old Olivia Jacob. A year and a half ago, Jacob was making $45,000 a year in the sales department at DHL, a global delivery firm.
When I walked into my boss's office and my other boss had papers in his hands, and I, at the time, kiddingly said, "So are those my termination papers?" And when their faces dropped, that was the answer I needed.
Now she delivers sandwiches for $8 an hour just to get by.
As lost as I get. Did we not pass this building already?
She's drained her savings.
I've had to actually sell some jewelry, which were a lot of my favorite pieces, but it's something you have to do.
Jacob has applied for work as a receptionist, pharmaceutical sales rep, ATM sales rep, customer service supervisor.
And nothing. I think it has a lot to do with lack of a college degree.
70% of working adults are like Jacob, no degree. MIT economist David Autor says this group is the most at risk in the hourglass economy.
It's not that there will be no jobs in the middle. It's just that there's relatively fewer opportunities of that type. If you think about good blue-collar production jobs or office administrative support jobs, those were often career occupations. They were things that offered certainly a sustainable standard of living.
And many economists think we've seen three straight recessions where the layoffs are mostly permanent. Why? Automation.
It wasn't long ago that many large businesses had people who just did typing and filing and phone answering. We don't see much of that anymore. Similarly, but at a slightly higher level, there are a lot of accounting and information processing jobs that also have been supplanted by hardware and software.
And sales jobs like Olivia Jacobs, too, as the internet replaces face-to-face transactions.
We economic developers have an old joke.
Charles Hayes runs an area business group, the Research Triangle Regional Partnership.
The manufacturing facility of the future will employ two people. One will be a man, and one will be a dog. And the man will be there to feed the dog, and the dog will be there to make sure the man doesn't touch the equipment.
Don't laugh too hard. Today, one of North Carolina's hottest tech sectors squeezes out human workers, replacing them with virtual people. Here's how.
Right away.
This video game simulates a hospital. It's called a synthetic environment. Real-world doctors and nurses play this game as part of their training, in lieu of actual trainers. Here, our virtual patient is suffering a virtual hemorrhage.
We need a radiologist. She needs an embolization. Stage 3, doctor.
The game developer, Virtual Heroes, is hiring. Pay here starts at $50,000 for college degree engineers who have kept their skills up to date. Ah, that old cliche of lifelong learning. It's true, says finance professor Raghuram Rajan at the University of Chicago.
In a competitive world, there are no safe jobs. Every job, in some sense, has to continuously be reinvented. Unfortunately, that's the truth.
And it hurts the most for those without a college degree. They're less in demand, so they make half of what people with a higher education make.
No, sir, it's not.
Beth Manis in suburban Raleigh has an answer to that, to upgrade herself and to start nursing school at the age of 44. As she cooks dinner with her stepson, pork chops, mashed potatoes, black-eyed peas, Manis describes working retail at a call center as a customer sales rep.
Enough is enough of being without financial security. Not only what I do, but my husband, who's a carpenter, has had low work. And I just want to find something so we can be sustained.
She says for the working class, economic mobility seems to be moving in just one direction, down. Again, David Autor at MIT.
The American society is very dependent on the belief that we're meritocratic and mobile, that people's success in life depends on their smarts and on their hard work and playing by the rules, not on accidents of birth.
Thing is, for that 70% of Americans with modest skills and modest education, he sees fewer and fewer shots at a middle-class life. In Raleigh, North Carolina, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You will, of course, want to know which jobs are the best paid and in the most promising fields and which ones are going to be obsolete maybe tomorrow. So look no further than our website for our future job-o-matic. It's at marketplace.org. Tomorrow's story in the series is the future job market and what babies born today might need to succeed. Coming up in just a little bit, what makes one painting the most stolen of all time?
First, for the greatness of the work of art itself, but then simply the fact of it having been desired by so many different people over so many centuries.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials put on 0.25% today, about 31 points, closed at 11,164. The NASDAQ up 0.4%, 11 points, finished at 2490. The S&P 500 tacked on 0.2%, 2 points, ended at 1185. Financial shares buckled today. Bank of America traded down about 2.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase gave back 1.75%. Morgan Stanley reversed about 0.5%. Goldman Sachs down 0.2%. Home builders got a boost from stronger new home sales last month. KB Home nailed 0.5% gain. D.R. Horton added 0.2%. Radio Shack lost frequency on news that sales of accessories and mobile phones were lower than expected. Shares relinquished 9% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.56%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At AllyBank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. The American Institute of CPAs concludes its annual National Tax Conference in Washington. And on October 26, 2001, President George W. Bush signed into law the USA Patriot Act. Stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are in the home stretch of the midterm election cycle, only one more week of campaign mailers and political ads to deal with. But if you think you're glad it's almost over, imagine for just a second the lives of the people inside the campaigns, the people who live and breathe and work the machinery of politics. That's who we're going to be hearing from the next couple of days on the broadcast, the people who frame the message and count the votes. Up first, the communicators with commentator Nicole Wallace.
The final days of a campaign are harrowing for everyone involved, but the communicators usually have it the roughest. We read the papers and political blogs online at ODark30, spar with our counterparts on the morning shows, fine-tune the candidate's message for the day, and try to get the campaign's top surrogates to sing from the same song sheet. Communicators is campaign parlance for the clump of staff responsible for the candidate's relationship with the press. Translation? We handle the press. I've worked on two presidential campaigns, for George W. Bush's re-election in 2004 and on Senator McCain's campaign in 2008. In 2004, we pioneered new technologies for targeting voters by reaching women at the gym and men at NASCAR races, and it worked. Those advances were rendered obsolete in 2008 when President Obama's campaign turned to social media to mobilize voters. What the Obama campaign accomplished online transformed modern-day campaigns and dramatically accelerated the news cycles. But my job was to make sure that what the candidate said got through. I was the first person to trot out a new line of attack. If we succeeded in getting the other campaign to stutter, we'd pass the new language on to the candidate. If it was a flop, we'd scrap it and look for something better for our candidate, for whom the stakes were much, much higher. When Senator McCain's campaign launched an ad called Celebrity, I appeared on four morning shows to make the case that then-candidate Obama was all flash and no substance. We finally had some traction, so Senator McCain carried the message throughout the day. The communicators are the tip of the spear on campaigns, but there is no tougher job than the one that the candidate performs. He or she is the one who's held up for scrutiny and subject to intrusions that were once unthinkable in American politics. Most people who work on campaigns consider themselves fortunate to be in the arena, but it's the communicators who have the best seats in the House.
Nicole Wallace's new book, as you might have seen in the New York Times yesterday, is called 18 Acres. It's a fictional account of America's first female president. Tomorrow in our series, The Life of a Pollster. But in the meantime, send us your comments. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. There's a painting in Belgium that just might be the most significant piece of art you've probably never heard of. The Ghent altarpiece, also called the Adoration of the Mystic Lamb, was painted almost 600 years ago. It's been stolen seven times since then, more than any other masterwork. If you happen to be within reach of your computer right now, you can have a look at it. It's right on our homepage, right on top there at marketplace.org. Art historian Noah Charney writes about the painting and the many crimes against it in his new book, Stealing the Mystic Lamb.
Well, this is a monumental triptych, a three-sectioned altarpiece that consists of 12 individual painted oaken panels linked together in an elaborate framework.
This is also, as you point out in the book, quite possibly the most, I think your phrase is, the most desired object in the history of mankind.
It's interesting that from the moment this was finished, it was the most famous painting in the European world. And it was because of a number of things that it did that no one had done before. And the painter, Jan van Eyck, in this painting was the first to paint monumental work, and this is huge. It's 14.5 by 11.5 feet, and it weighs 2 tons, which makes its many thefts particularly impressive. It's the first to use an intricate microscopic level of detail, like the effect of water seen through glass, the light reflecting in a horse's eye, botanically identifiable plants, which no one had done before. He used disguised symbolism, so in terms of the history of Catholicism and Catholic mysticism, it's very important.
Why did people steal this thing so much?
Not only was it the most famous painting in Europe when it was completed, but there was a cumulative series of wars that passed over the territory that was known as Flanders and is now Belgium. And so the painting was stolen by invading armies on a number of occasions, as well as by individuals. And then ultimately, in the Second World War, this was the number one work of art that the Allied monuments and fine arts officers were hunting because it had been stolen by the Nazi art theft unit, the ERR. And it was destined to be the centerpiece of Hitler's planned super museum. And the reason it was so desired is at first for the greatness of the work of art itself, but then simply the fact of it having been desired by so many different people over so many centuries. There was this cumulative urge to possess what no one else had been able to retain.
It almost makes sense that armies would want to steal a painting like this or other great works because they can claim it and take it and display it. But in a more general sense, the theft of art, specifically high-profile art like this, almost makes no sense. I mean, it's not like there's a secondary market where you can sell the thing.
Well, you're right. And one of the things that's interesting is the misconception that the general public has, through no fault of their own, based on perpetuation of both media and fiction, that most art crime involves criminal collectors. And in reality, it's actually much more sinister. Since the Second World War, the majority of art crimes are involved with organized crime syndicates. And the criminals have learned that trying to sell the work of art is nearly impossible. So rather than looking for the buyer, criminal organizations have begun to use stolen art as a sort of tool, a chip, to use in barter or collateral deals with other organized crime groups, trading stolen art for other goods like drugs and firearms.
So this is kind of down in the economic weeds, but how do you set the price point for a work of art that you, organized crime group A, wants to barter for drugs and guns with organized crime group B? I mean, how do they figure that out?
Well, the price is usually set at 7 to 10% of its estimated legitimate value. But quite often, the value is actually broadcast by the media because there's such a pleasure in the media reporting these high prices for which art sells at auction that the announcement that, you know, a $100 million Caravaggio has been stolen, that newspaper that has that headline is what criminals will use to say, aha, this painting that I just stole is worth $100 million. Therefore, I can probably get $7 to $10 million on the black market.
Noah Charney's book is called Stealing the Mystic Lamb. It's about a piece of art called the Ghent Altarpiece, also known as the Adoration of the Mystic Lamb, hence the title. Noah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Part of the Mystic Lamb, one whole panel of it, actually, is still missing. You can visit our website to hear me and Noah talking about what might have happened to it. We've got an excerpt of the book there as well. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a fond farewell to an electronic gadget that really I didn't even know they made anymore. Sony said on Friday that it has stopped making the Walkman, the cassette Walkman specifically, that first hit stores 30 years ago. Now, first of all, cassettes, when was the last time you even saw one of those? But secondly, and more seriously, you remember the first time you put the headphones on and turned whatever you were listening to up real loud and then had your own little universe? I don't know. I think that was a little bit of magic right there, if you ask me. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow put on 31 points, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 tacked on 2 points, 0.2%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in to the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Back here next time, kids are the future of the American job market. So, hey, start them early.
Children born today will spend part of their lives abroad if they are successful professionals.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.